Federal funding cuts strike rural EMS services. Getting stabbed, just part of the job. Crazy patients might sue you. And we'll look at the use of social media as a public education tool for healthcare. If that's what you're looking for, you found it right here on this week's episode of the MedicCast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the MedicCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the PodMedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the PodMedic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to this week's program. We have a great show coming forward. We have a great show coming up for you this week. I'm looking forward to it. I got a lot of things coming up, including several EMS news items looking at how injuries on the job from assault are becoming all too commonplace. Then we're going to have a special segment from our podcast studio at NACHO Annual Conference with a look at how public health and EMS can use social media to reach out to the public in times of crisis and emergency conditions. All of that's coming up later on in this episode, so stay tuned here after the news. Before we get to that, though, I do want to remind you to please make sure you check out all of the information, the additional links and resources available for you over at the MedicCast blog. You'll find that over at MedicCast.com/blog. There's a show notes link at the top of the page. Just click that link and it'll take you right over to the most recent episodes. You can then scroll down and go back to find previous episodes you want to look for. All of that's available for you over on the site. There's also a search box there, so you can check out and see what you're looking for. If you're looking for something in particular, just enter some search terms in there, and that should help you out. Take some time and make sure you follow up on the information you get on the show. Understand how it applies to your EMS practice and protocols. That's important. It's something you need to do. Now, if you want to get back in touch with me, I hope you'll do so. Make sure you email me here at podmedic@mac.com. Just shoot me an email with your comments, your questions on the show, maybe something you'd like to see in a future episode, a suggestion or an interview idea for a future episode. Either way, I hope you'll respond to me, and I do work hard to get back to each and every one of you when emails come in. So keep those emails coming. Also, if you're an iPhone, an Android, a Windows phone, or now a Windows 8 user, you can check out our brand new free MedicCast app available for you in the store for that device. It's free, it's available for you, and you can get all the episodes of the MedicCast checked out there. Just search for MedicCast EMS app. And if you already have it, make sure you go back and leave a comment and rate the app. Be an active supporter of the MedicCast community by leaving a recommendation or a rating on the application. That's enough contact information. We'll get on into the week's news up next, but always remember, support our sponsors and make sure you let them know you heard it here on the MedicCast. It helps keep the show coming out for you each week free and keeps the lights on here at MedicCast Studios. So take a moment and tell them thanks for supporting the show. Kicking off the news this week, we're going to look at a problem that is affecting many rural EMS services around the country. Federal funding cuts and the sequestration problems that are happening in D.C. are trickling down and affecting reimbursement for many ambulance companies around the United States. There's an article I looked at from East Texas that explains this in detail for that area, looking at this area of eastern Texas being affected by the removal of ambulances from a significant portion of their coverage area. East Texas Medical Center EMS announced that services were being discontinued for a significant portion of its coverage area. The ambulance service currently operates a fleet of over 100 ambulances and also 3 medevac helicopters in 17 Texas counties. The announcement is affecting many small towns that have decided because of the change that they cannot afford to cover fees that are being added or would be associated with hiring their own ambulance service. East Texas Medical Center EMS used to provide services for free, recouping their costs through insurance and Medicare billing. But with the federal funding cuts and the sequestration cutbacks that happened with Medicare billing, they can no longer afford to offer these services for free. Medicare and Medicaid rates for ambulance services were set all the way back in 2000 and have not kept up with the cost of inflation, let alone the cost of increased fuel, rising cost of medical care, and staffing. Many rural ambulance services are facing similar stark realities. And while the urban and suburban ambulance services can make up some of the difference in volume of calls, in rural areas, this just isn't something they can do. Call volume is often very low in these regions. So is your service facing similar cutbacks? What are they doing to address income reduced for their billing services? Let me know. I'd love to hear from you. Shoot me an email to podmedic@mac.com and let me know what's going on in your neck of the woods. I look forward to hearing from you. Moving on in the news this week, let's take a look at a major issue with scene safety and provider safety. Recently, a New Jersey EMT was stabbed by a patient during an assault recently when that drunk patient was en route to the hospital. Jersey City Medical Center Director of Emergency Medical Services, Robert Luckritz, I hope I got his name right, says that this is sometimes just part of an EMT's job. Really? It's part of the job? Well, he does go on to say that it's a significant issue and that EMTs need to do a better job of reporting patient assaults when they occur. But really part of the job? A study in 2005 found that 62% of EMTs are injured by a patient at some point during their career in EMS. Now, this is a good article, I think, because it reminds us that it's not always the patient of an assault or an expected violent patient that causes these injuries. I believe, and studies seem to show, that more injuries and assaults are occurring when the patient catches the EMS provider by surprise. I believe one of the solutions we can do is to encourage training, situational awareness, and other things for our EMS professionals. We need to include unusual situations like unexpected assaults in our training scenarios. Now, there are some good training programs out there on provider safety and provider self-defense, but you know, you need to really look for them. Have you engaged in any of this kind of training? I'd like to hear about it. What about getting assaulted on the job? Has this happened to you? This is something that needs to be reported, and not just to supervisors, but to national organizations like the NAEMT, the National Association of EMTs, so they can advocate for us at the state and national level to our legislators. The bottom line is, at the end of the day, we need to feel safe and stay safe and get home to our families safely. So remember, I end each episode of the show, I'm not just reciting something random, I really mean it. So please keep in mind, folks, scene safety, and BSI. Finally in the news this week, we look at another unusual story about a patient who is blaming EMS in some way for something. I got this article from the Village Voice website. A Bronx woman is suing police officers and emergency medical services providers for injuries that occurred when she escaped custody and later ended up leaping from a third-story window. Now, apparently, police were called for a mentally ill individual breaking car windows on a city street. An ambulance was also dispatched. The patient was detained by the police and later placed in the back of an ambulance at the scene. But sometime during this situation, the patient apparently got out of custody, ran from the back of the ambulance and into a nearby building, later leaping from a third-story window to the sidewalk below, and they did incur some injuries. They were unknown at the time of the writing of the article. Where does responsibility for this patient begin and end? That's the question, I think, that is being asked in the lawsuit. And I would argue it should also be discussed among ourselves as well. The lawsuit is arguing that patients should have been restrained because when they have mental distress and they're obviously agitated, we should restrain them. But we know that restraint is something we only use as a last resort when transporting a patient, unless we have police riding along with us and additional resources. I think this is a cautionary tale for all of us. We need to be aware of what our patients are doing once we have them in our care, and we shouldn't leave them unattended in the back of an ambulance, especially when perhaps they are mentally disturbed. Now, I want to make it clear, I'm not second-guessing these EMTs. I'd never do that in a story like this, so please understand that. There's just not enough information to say whether or not they had the patient strapped to the cot or whether they were in the process of determining who had custody of the patient when chatting, when talking with police officers. But I think it's a good article to begin discussion among ourselves about how we care for these types of patients and ultimately protect ourselves from lawsuits like this one. So I'd like you to show this article to your training officer and maybe your medical director. Ask them for an opinion. Perhaps we need to add some training to your schedule. Maybe look at how to handle situations like this one. I welcome your thoughts. Please send them in to me by email. You can send them in to podmedic@mac.com or leave a comment in the comments link on this article so everybody can see it. Either way, I'd love to hear from you about what you think. This week on The Tip of the Week, I bring you a special segment from our recent trip to the NACHO Annual Conference in Dallas, Texas. Now, this is a conference for local health officials from across the country. I sat down and chatted in our podcast studio with Andy Rozak from NACHO and Jim Garrow from the City of Philadelphia Department of Health. Now, we had a great discussion where we talked about the use of social media as a way to reach out to our communities and educate them about some of the health issues we want to make them aware of, as well as alerting them to emergency situations that might affect their health. So check this discussion out we had about social media and healthcare. So we're having a good time here at NACHO Annual, and I've got two great guys to sit down with and talk about social media, Andy Rozak and Jim Garrow, and both of you, welcome. This is a great topic to kind of kick off here because we are in the podcast studio, and we've been tweeting and putting Facebook posts out there continually for the last 2 days, and it's been a great conference. But there certainly are places out there, and health departments can always do more. So Jim, before we get into that question, introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
My name is Jim Garrow. I work at the Philly Health Department, and I do a lot of our emergency risk communication, especially around social media. I manage our department's Twitter account, and I help out with our Facebook page. And we found it to be a great way to really get our messages out in a way that is snackable, is the new term. Instead of putting out a whole fact sheet or a whole press release, we'll take out little bits and bites and sprinkle them out throughout the day. We found it's a really great way to keep up interest in some of the topics that we're working on.
Excellent. And Andy, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure, absolutely. My name is Andy Rozak. I'm the Director of Catastrophic and Pandemic Preparedness at NACHO. And before that, worked for the federal government for a while, firefighter, paramedic, and avid user of social media.
Yeah, and I think that what you just alluded to is one of the benefits of social media is engaging the public in a brand new way. You don't have to wait until they read it in the paper or see the soundbite on the news. They can actually be getting information directly from their public health providers out there.
One of the things that we found most beneficial is that we really think that social media helps us, and this is a terrible way to put it, but get around the media. So many times we'll sit down with an interview for them or get on the phone and talk for a half hour and then see 5 seconds of that show up on the news. This is a way for us to tell our whole story. And a lot of times public health kind of, people only see the bad side of public health when things go wrong. And this is a great way for us to tell the positive side of things. So.
And encourage good behaviors and do all those things that you can reach out and remind people, keep this in mind the next time you're ordering a soda, order a small,
or
change your beverage, or whatever you want to do in the messaging.
Yeah, and it's good, too, for topical things. How many times has the media ignored our West Nile virus messaging? And it's on people's mind now. There's lots of rain out there, so there's lots of standing water, and this is a great opportunity for us to tell people to dump that water out. So it's helpful, I think, in day-to-day stuff, but I'm sure, as Andy will tell you, We use it a lot in emergencies, too, and have found that those timely, topical tweets and Facebook messages really draw interest and help boost our followings.
You know, I remember it's been 2-3 years now when the blizzard came through the East Coast, hit the East Coast, the Central Atlantic, and I'm just below Philly in Maryland. You know how much snow we got, two back-to-back storms there. Interestingly enough, our local small-town police department of 3 police officers had a Twitter account. Our county did not, and it was that account I started following because they were the ones that were saying, hey, the emergency plan is still in effect. Do not go out on the roads unless you're an emergency responder. Right. You shouldn't be out on the highways, and it was they were the ones who said that. That's now lifted. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got that information, and I'm sure I wasn't alone in that.
And I think that's, you know, a good point. We have to go where people are. And, you know, we live in a world now where there's more cell phones than there are toilets or toothbrushes. Mm-hmm. So if you truly are looking to reach the public, this is one viable means of doing so. And it's low cost, too. You know, it doesn't cost anything to sign up for Facebook or Twitter. They're both great resources that you can use at your local health department, at your police department, your fire department, to really reach out to that target audience. Now, we know we're not going to get everybody, but let's be honest, we're not getting everybody now with the mechanisms for
you. You're going to get more than you're going to get with other media sources in an additive effect alone. And it, again, it's so simple and easy to use. It's such a tool. Your experience, Andy, and your role with NACHO, what's the uptake on that? Are more and more health departments and more preparedness agencies in different areas using this type of social media?
Well, I think obviously the answer is yes. You know, you see throughout the country varying degrees of uptake. You know, some are on social media and using it just for surveillance, so really no active engagement, but they are on there monitoring and checking in on things. Others are very robust, and obviously Jim's a great example of that. And I think, you know, really as Jim can attest, it's kind of a transitional time now. We've got some health departments that really understand and embrace the technology and can see the value and the benefit. But at the same time, there's a cost to that. If you're sending tweets or doing Facebook or doing all this and doing it well, then that means you're not doing something else. And, you know, since 2008, we've lost 40,000 jobs at the local health department level. So there's a lot of work that needs to go around. And, you know, some folks honestly can't justify or don't see the value in having some play on Facebook or play on Twitter all day when they could be doing more, you know, substantial things. I personally don't think that's the right approach. I think you need a balanced approach. But, you know, we have to be honest and confront these issues head on and realize that not everybody's on board with this social media thing, because it is hard to quantify, it is hard to show the value, especially it's hard to show the return on investment. And I know we've kind of talked offline about this a few times, Jim. I think in the future you're going to see this really turn into somebody's full-time job. Active engagement, you know, retweeting folks, answering questions, especially during disaster, because this is the medium that people are using. You know, Twitter works via text message in addition to the apps on the smartphones. So if the landlines or the cell towers go down or have limited capability, odds are you can probably still get a text message out. And we saw that during Sandy and some of the hurricane or the tornadoes that we've had this year. It's really a viable mean of communication. But the key is you've got to be on there, you've got to be engaging, you've got to be listening, and you've got to be responding. And that again, takes manpower and takes time. So, I mean, I'm curious, you know, you do such a great job. You know, we've talked again about some of these struggles that you've had. Where are we with that, you know, balance? I mean, obviously your leadership is great and they embrace it and everything else. What would you say are some tips to help convince others that this is a worthwhile, you know, venture?
Well, it's really a process. It's just a fact. Not every health department can do this right now. But I think we're seeing, especially in the private sector, this has become a priority. And it's become a priority because it at least companies that have to depend on quarterly statements and making money all the time find this to be a valuable way to do what they do. And as we start to see the stories coming out of their successes, I think that's when we'll be able to convince a lot more leadership that this is a successful way to do this. And a great example is the American Red Cross. They're a nonprofit, and they deal with disasters every single day, and they've got an entire operation center set up just around social media, just so they can monitor what's going on. And they think the return on investment is huge. They have digital volunteers across the nation that are ready and willing to stand up and actually help out online. They don't have to go to the scene anymore. They actually are able to distribute information from wherever they are and support the response effort. So I think it's a process. There are agencies and there are organizations that are making the time for this, and it's those are the people that are going to create the best practices, and those are the people who are going to set what the priority should be. And over time, the rest of the folks will come along. And if your health department isn't ready yet, well, that's okay. But keep an eye on the space because this isn't a fad. I just learned a great stat the other day. Facebook will be 10 years old next year. This isn't a fad that's going away. People are doing this all the time. Another great stat that I give in my presentations is between 4 and 12% of Americans have interrupted sex to check on a social media message.
Wow.
Which is...
That's an interesting stat.
I don't know if it's been replicated or not, but this is... I saw that in a study, and this is the way people live their lives. They do it on social media, and Andy makes a great point. We have to be message where people are at, or they're not going to hear our messages.
Well, and we're not going to hear them, and I think that there's... You talk about the surveillance, those that are using it for surveillance. I think of the recent plane crash in San Francisco, and how much was going on in Twitter. The national news agencies that were trying to cover this were picking up people tweeting passengers that had gotten off the aircraft, tweeting pictures, using that as a responder, as to give yourself a picture of what you're getting into before you ever get to the scene. The power of that, if it's just available, there are opportunities there during an active event for public health to engage with the public and find out, where are these hot spots that we're hearing about, and to trying to nail it down, contacting people they see online in an offline, directing that conversation offline so you can get more data, more information.
Well, a great example of that was Hurricane Sandy, and to me that was the social media emergency watershed event. We have pictures from inside the hurricane. We have pictures from, lower Manhattan with all the lights out, and it was all because people, that's how they interact with the world. They take pictures of these things and they post them online. And, years ago we never would have had this information. We never would have been able to see people stuck in the middle of raging torrents in the middle of, a Manhattan street. But now we do, and we can utilize that information if we're aware of it and looking for it. A great example is Emily Rahimi, who runs the FDNY Twitter account.
Okay.
During Hurricane Sandy, she was working that night, and as is standard, their fire department has a rule that people aren't supposed to contact them that way through emergency. You're supposed to use 911, which makes sense. It's not hooked into the dispatch system. But at one point, she got a call or a Twitter message from someone saying they needed help, they need to be evacuated, and she directed them to 911, and he said, "I can't call out. I have no power, so my phone doesn't work, and the cell towers are overloaded with voice calls. Twitter is the only way I can ask you for help." And if we're not listening, those calls go unheeded, unfortunately.
I think that you raise an important point there in saying that social media has an opportunity to interact with people in ways beyond the commonplace. Mm-hmm. And that's a great example of how we need to meet the people where they are.
And I think, like anything else, you're going to get false calls to 911, you're going to get fake calls, and some of the stuff we see on Twitter, of course, it's not true, or it's not, so it does take that caveat of we have to validate some of this stuff. And we've come a long way with, geolocation tags and, all this stuff that we can do now to try to validate it. But even the posts that you see that are fake, for every one fake post you see, you get hundreds that are truly valid and truly an accurate representation of what's going on in the community. So I think we've kind of passed that tipping point where people are malicious and posting stuff, falsely.
Well, we've also seen, too, and we have a great example from H1N1 in my department, of sometimes the community self-corrects. People will post false things or inflammatory things, and members of the community are invested in the safety and security of their neighborhoods, so they'll essentially shout these people down. We had anti-vaccine posts on our Facebook page during H1N1, and in the time it took us to approve a message to respond to them, members of the community posted and replied and essentially gave the right information in lieu of this person. So we left the entire conversation standing because we thought it was such a great example of the community supporting public health.
And it brings them in as a partnership. Right. They truly are, and that's what social media does so well, is engagement. And I think sometimes public health struggles to engage with their public effectively. So this is just a great tool to help lend to that and still take people to the traditional methods of engagement, but certainly something to be aware of. Jim, any final thoughts as we wrap up here?
Just one about, and this I really direct this to public health agencies that haven't started or are just struggling to get started. Somewhere in your organization there's a champion. There's someone who loves to do this and really, really wants to do it. And and they may not be in IT, they may not be in communications, but this is something that they really enjoy and they're willing to spend their own personal time to do it. Find that person, that's your champion. That's the person who will do extra during the day, even though it's not in their job description, just because they think it's the right thing to do and it's the important thing to do. That's the person you should be talking to.
Great, well thank you. Andy, any final thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think as we look, you know, to Public Health 2020 and beyond, this is just another mechanism that we have to embrace and have to utilize. Technology is changing ever so fast, and that means that customers, our clients, our citizens, will come to expect this of public agencies. So, you know, this is something that sooner or later we're all going to have to face. As Jim said, it's probably not going away. You've got Pinterest, you've got Instagram, you've got Facebook, you've got Twitter, you've got Vine, you've got who knows what the next thing will be. But if you truly want to be proactive and reach the public, you know, you need to be out there doing stuff that the public's doing. And this is not your traditional media. We don't have the luxury of time in these situations, at least in emergency situations, to get messages approved ahead of time. And I think we're starting to see a shift in some of the government agencies where we're going from approving tweets like we used to approve press releases. Instead of approving every tweet that goes out, you approve a person and you trust that person. You hope that they exercise sound judgment. But, you know, even if you do mess up at the end of the day, folks are pretty forgiving. So I think it's a new paradigm that's happening. I think it's one that we should embrace. And anything we can do to increase our message and increase our outreach should at least be examined. And if it's not for you, it's not for you. But just recognize that there is some folks that are very good at this, and people are very willing to help. And I know Jamie, Jim, myself, would be more than happy to tell you anything you want to know about social media.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a champion for everyone to be using it in healthcare, and so I certainly make myself always available to talk to somebody. I think, you know, like you said earlier, it doesn't have to take an all-day job, full-time position. Mm-hmm. It can be, you know, 10 or 15 minutes a day devoted to it. Yeah. Can be enough to really get yourself a good foothold and get started. Jim, Andy, thanks a lot for being on.
Thanks so much, James.
Thank you.
And I want to thank all of you for checking out this segment from NACHO Annual 2013. Make sure you check back here for all of the other segments we're recording here. We're having a great time with lots of great information for you, and you need to check all of it out. We'll see you soon. That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show this week and remind you to follow up on all of the information from this week's show over at mediccast.com/blog. When you get there, you'll find the show notes link right there at the top of the page, and you can take a moment and check out and follow up on all of that information, the links to the news items you find there, also all of the tips and additional resource links I put there. All of that's there for you as well. You can also sign up for the email newsletter while you're there. There's a little form right there on the right-hand side of the page. Just fill that out, and you can actually get all those links and things sent directly to your email inbox every week. I also welcome your comments and suggestions directly by email, so if you want to, shoot me an email to podmedic@mac.com. You can send in your news links, ideas for future show topics or interviews, whatever comments you might have. I look forward to hearing from you. And let me know, because I will make sure I get back in touch with you. I work hard to respond to every email that comes in, so please, please keep those emails coming. If you want to catch up with me on social media sites and pages, well, you can do that. You can find me most places under the handle PodMedic. So catch me over at Twitter or Facebook, twitter.com/PodMedic or facebook.com/PodMedic, and friend or follow me on those sites. You can also check out the MedicCast on our very own Facebook page. We have over 4,000 followers there. It's growing all the time. Head over and join this growing community at facebook.com/MedicCast. Click the like button at the top of the page and join the MedicCast community over there. That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. Please make sure you spread the word and share the MedicCast with your colleagues and students in the EMS world. I'll be back here each week with new episodes, new interviews, tips, and more every Monday morning so you can kick off your EMS week. Tell somebody else about the MedicCast today and share the show with somebody you know. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. It's time to close out the show. Don't forget to thank our sponsors, and remember, folks, scene safety. BSI.